What is not started will never get finished. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 49 of Making Comics Gutter Talk. My name is Adam Greenfield. I am the host. That quote you just heard was from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. He was around during the 18th and 19th century, German man, wore several hats, most notably as a writer, from things like poetry and novels to plays. Also a philosopher as well, politician, did a lot of things. But I have to admit, I just kind of like the quote. I've never really read the guy's stuff. So maybe one day, though. One day. All right. Before I even read that guy's stuff, let's get into today's episode. It is with Eric Schanauer. He is a fantastic artist who is the mastermind behind things like Age of Bronze, Adventures in Oz, and others. We actually recorded this in the restaurant I live above here in San Diego called Alchemy. If you live in San Diego and have never been, or if you are visiting San Diego and have never been, I suggest you go. It is awesome. The food there is great. And just scream at the window and say hi. But anyway, we did it before they were, going to open. So I think we may have rushed the kitchen a little bit. So I apologize for that, but they were kind enough to wait till we were done to not make too much noise. But that was really awesome of them to open their doors for us. So again, Alchemy. Check it out. All right. Before we jump into the conversation I had with Eric, there's just something I want to bring up. I've heard a lot of artists talk about this, and it's wishing they had done what they were doing sooner. Now I also have my bouts in the ring with this sort of thing. I hesitate to call it regret. I don't know. While I do wish some things in my life were different, I don't know. I've experienced a lot in my life, and some of those experiences probably wouldn't have happened if I wasn't an idiot. There's a sentence you don't hear every day. Now this could also really apply to everyone with everything constructive they do. Now, if you're not doing something constructive, please just stay home on your couch, not do anything at all. That's fine. But really they're not who I'm talking to. I'm talking to those that even at the very least, they have the desire to do something. That's right. Talking to you. I know you have the best intentions and so do I. Now, that said, what the hell are we waiting for? You know, these kinds of successes and these things just don't happen. They require at least, at the very least, some sort of effort. Do you get a prize for showing up? No, you don't. Is there a reward for thinking about something a lot? Nope. Unless you're a masochist, and there are plenty of painful rewards coming your way then. But as the, you know, regular listeners know, I have been working on this NaNoWriMo challenge here, and it's the first time I'd written something extensive in nearly 2 years. I kind of thought my mojo was gone, and every time I tried to write, that stupid blinking cursor kept winking at me cruelly. No words would come out, so I just shut the computer down out of frustration. Sometimes I'd get the urge to write, not about anything in particular. I'd just get the urge to write, but I wouldn't do it because I was afraid of not being able to write anything and feeling kind of down about it. Writing is one of the very few times in my life where I feel like all is right in the world, or at least in the world I'm in at the time. To not be able to have that anymore, that was kind of frightening. So I did what I did, and I cut my nose off to spite my face and just didn't write anything at all. Now, in the year that I've been doing this podcast, I have learned several things about this. First, I am definitely not alone. There are countless people out there, perhaps one of them is you, who struggles with this fear and anger of not being able to produce anything. Just, we are not alone. So just remember that. It's one thing that I've been reminding myself. Second, no one succeeds by not doing anything. This is, you know, that quote I started off this intro with. Now, I know that sounds obvious, but our artistic brains, they like to overanalyze things. We tend to ignore the obvious, fester in the difficult. So comments like, the one I made, you know, no one succeeds by not doing anything. They tend to get overlooked. You know, even though these basic concepts are the foundation of being productive, you know, it's your basic principles of drawing, really. It's use that as a comparison. So is it an age thing? Is it a maturity thing? You know, is it in our DNA or our upbringing, you know, maybe how we were raised, or maybe there's some outside force that's become the voice in our heads? I don't know. I wish I did. I really do. But what I do know is that the future really doesn't provide much of anything besides theories and dreams and hopes. What really makes a difference is what you do right now. This moment, this time right here, to start that comic that's been bouncing around in your head for 6 years, or write that story idea that smacked you in your internal face a few months back. So I ask again, what the hell are we waiting for? Speaking of not waiting around anymore, this is Eric Schanauer. I'm actually going to hold it because it's just going to be easier for me. Oh. All right. This is actually the first time I've recorded here. We're in Alchemy Restaurant. If anybody listening has ever been to South Park San Diego, definitely check this place out. So it's a cool place. We are with Eric Schanauer. How you doing, Eric?
I'm doing well, Adam. How are you?
Doing well myself. Before we get too started, I actually want to bring something up. You and I actually have a really eerily similar geographical path. You were born in Key West, Florida.
I was
born in Homestead.
I don't know where
that's
that is.
Just outside of Miami.
Okay.
So Southern Florida. You then moved to Laurel, Maryland.
Well, after a few moves. There are a few moves in between there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I lived in Columbia, Maryland. I grew up and hung out in Laurel and Jessup all the time. So there's that. Novato, California.
Yeah.
I spent a couple of years there in the early to mid 80s. And now.
Really? Yeah. How early 80s?
83 to 86, 83 to 85. So I think you had just graduated from high school.
Graduated in 81. But my parents still lived there. And so I was back there during the summers. The last time I lived there for any extended period of time was summer of 83.
Okay.
But my parents lived in Novato until a couple years ago. So I was back there, you know, to visit.
What's it like? I haven't been back in a little while. I'm sure it's a heck of a lot different.
I don't know what Novato's like, really. I mean, I just was visiting my parents for like Christmas and things like that.
Yeah.
I never, when I lived there, when I was in high school, we lived on Hamilton Air Force Base.
That's where I lived. Bowling Drive.
Really?
Yeah.
Where's Bowling?
It's the big hill. And you go in, you first enter, from what I remember, you first enter and you take a right and it goes down this hill and dips around and then it comes back up. So it's the big loop that goes around.
After you go, I mean, there was like, okay. You go over after the bridge, there's a little bridge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So, I lived on South Oakwood.
Yeah. Okay.
Which was pretty close. I mean, I used to ride my bike to the exchange to buy comics and, I would go back on Bowling Drive because the other way was up that huge hill and down
hill.
The other hill.
Yep. Yeah. We lived all the way down at the bottom of that hill. I actually went back, and this is totally a tangent because we're here to talk about comics. but when I was back a little while ago, I tried going back to the bottom of that hill where the houses that we lived on, and they're no longer there. In fact, they were used to be on like a little bit of a rise because I remember I had to go up steps to get to the housing. Now they're all on street level.
Really?
It looks totally different.
Really?
Just completely different.
Well, I know. It's totally decommissioned.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
They were building, like, low-income housing in the, like, there's, I don't know if they were, like, the enlisted quarters.
I'm not sure.
Because we were in the officer. I assume your dad was an officer. Yeah. Because we were in the officer's housing over there, better housing.
The better housing.
Yeah. I haven't driven through there. It's been a few years. Every once in a while. My parents don't live there anymore, so I have no reason to go to Novato, but every once in a while I would drive through there just to see what it was like.
So how old were you when you lived in Novato?
I was in 11th and 12th grade.
11th and 12th grade.
I graduated from high school there.
Okay. All right. Well, you brought up something actually, comics. When you would go to the exchange, they actually sold comics there.
Yeah.
Okay. And what would you, what was some of your earliest comics that you read?
Earliest? Yeah. Or comics I bought in Novato.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that was a good, in your teenage years, wasn't it? Let's go back further then. Let's go, because I want to know, I kind of want to know about the, growing up in Maryland, I wasn't, comics weren't my focus. I was doing other things. So, in all the places that you've lived, you know, what were some of, do you remember the differences in the comics that you would, go looking for?
Well, the first real comic book I remember was an issue of Bambi published by Gold Key.
Really?
An adaptation of Disney's Bambi movie. I still have it somewhere. My mother would try to throw it out periodically, but I was always, would always rescue it from the garbage. I also read Tintin because it was serialized in this magazine called Children's Digest.
I remember that.
My grandmother gave me a subscription to when I was five years old.
Okay.
And so that was the only really good part of the magazine.
Right.
Comics. I read the jokes and maybe did the crosswords once in a while. But that's how I was exposed to Tintin, and I loved it. I also read comics, and then, you know, in the newspaper, my parents read the comics in the Sunday newspaper to me.
Right.
I remember not really liking Pogo when I was very young.
I vaguely remember that.
But, when I got, you know, later, I really loved Pogo, and I still love Pogo.
Okay.
But when I was a kid, I couldn't stand it.
Do you remember what it was about it that you didn't like?
I just didn't understand it.
Okay.
They talked weird, and they talked way too much.
Were the comics, you know, the Sunday comics, you know, it seemed, because I also used to read them as well. I would always look for, that was the only time of the week that I would read something from the newspaper.
Right.
You know? So when I did read it, you know, I had to skip over a lot of it because I was like, I have no idea what's going on in some of these. Do you think that that was maybe a problem for kids to get into comics, or do you think that there were plenty of other outlets for them to reach? To get their level of comics?
I don't know. I never really thought about it that way. I mean, I read the Sunday comics for years, so different strips made different impressions on me at different times. Trying to follow Prince Valiant when I was really little was, there's like no point.
Right.
But then
right.
later, you know, I would read Prince Valiant every week and wait for it to get good, but, you know.
It's Prince Valiant.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Maybe this is heresy, but when I was reading Prince Valiant as a teenager, it just was never that good.
Yeah. Yeah. I never read it much, but.
You know, getting comic books, it was harder to get comic books as a kid. When I started buying comic book, the first time I bought a comic book on my own, I asked my dad to drive me to 7-Eleven to buy a comic book, and it was in Laurel, Maryland. I was in probably third grade, and I bought an issue of Casper. It was 12 cents. They were still 12 cents then, which is shocking to me now.
Okay. Yeah, because
71 or 72.
Okay.
But then, soon after that, I convinced my dad every Sunday after church we had to stop at 7-Eleven so I could buy a comic book, and usually my sister, who was a couple years younger than me, bought one too.
Okay.
We used our allowance.
Nice. What did she get?
At that time, I was almost always getting a Harvey comic, Casper or Richie Rich. Richie Rich was my very favorite.
Okay.
And, you know, I would buy Casper or whatever Hot Stuff or Little Dot or whatever Harvey comic. Harvey Comics were the thing.
Sure.
Although, you know, I experimented once or twice with something from Marvel or DC, and I bought a couple of Archie comics, but my mother was very uncomfortable with my sister and me buying violent comics, so she really frowned on superhero comics.
Yeah.
And so, although she didn't forbid us to buy them, there was still this pressure, so I just sort of stayed away from
them.
Was
that the guilt?
I bought Disney comics once in a while, but really it was just the Harvey comics. Richie Rich was my absolute favorite.
Was your family upbringing pretty religious or just kind of on the fringe?
Well, we were Lutheran, okay. So we were Protestant, and you know, there was always, we went to church every week. Okay. There was always church. My mother she went through this sort of fundamentalist phase when I was in late elementary, junior high school. So, the Bible and church became much more of a focus then. But I guess on an average, we were pretty religious, although it didn't seem very religious to me.
Right. Okay. Cause we've had a couple podcasts over the year that where people have talked about how religion has sort of shaped some of the things that they've done, either whether it's reading or creating. So I'm curious if that has ever happened.
Well, certainly, a view of any kind of supernatural being, God, or whatever, certainly informs the project, my main project now, which is Age of Bronze,
right.
My retelling of the Trojan War. I've removed all overt supernatural elements from the story, and that is definitely a statement on religion, all religion, not just Christianity.
Well, with multiple gods now. I mean, it's not, I was raised Jewish.
Yeah.
Just one, you know? Let's talk a little bit about your education. Did you take a lot of, I assume you started drawing a lot when you started, once you can get your hands on reading comics.
I always drew as far as back as I can remember.
Okay.
My first explicit memory of something artistic was in kindergarten, where the assignment was in class to come up with this sort of underwater collage, and we were cutting out shapes from construction paper. Okay. I cut out a crab, and everybody in class said, "Oh, that's so good." Yeah. And I had made this fish too. I liked the fish much better than the crab, but no one cared about the fish.
Welcome to art.
Yeah.
It's funny.
And I must have been drawing before that, but I don't specifically remember
what started
drawing before that. I do remember drawing by the time I was 6 years old.
Okay. Did you take a lot of classes? Did your parents encourage it?
Yeah. My parents recognized that I had some sort of talent, and they were anxious to encourage both my sister and me in our talents and interests.
Does your sister, is she an artist as well?
No, she draws a little, and she's taken art classes, often with me when we were kids. But she's much more of a musician.
Oh, cool.
She, I guess, showed some sort of aptitude for that because my parents had her taking piano lessons by the time she was in first grade, and she had piano lessons, and she went to college as a music major. And
very cool. So the creative aspect of
they
really encouraged that.
Yeah,
that's good.
Well, my parents were also, they just believed that everyone should know how to play a musical instrument, just because everyone should.
I agree.
Whether you stick with it or not, I had to learn.
No, so what did you?
Well, I took piano lessons after my sister started because it was just, I was curious, and she was learning something, and that just seemed interesting to me. I didn't stick with them very long. I did play the clarinet in high school.
Okay. Did you like that at all?
I mean, it was fine. I mean, I'm not a musician.
Okay. All
right. I'm glad for the experience, and I can sort of read music now. I mean, I know when I look at a piece of music, what's going on.
Right.
I understand, but I don't think I could play anything. I could probably play with my right hand on the piano.
Right.
But that's about it. And not very well.
The Peanuts theme song. You know, really simple stuff.
That's a little more complicated.
All right, fair enough.
I mean, We're talking rudimentary.
Okay.
Here.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. I played trumpet for 8 years and then guitar for since then. So I've been playing music since I was 7.
Yeah.
It's a hobby for me. You know, like
what
I want to do professionally is not that, but I enjoy it anyway. So my mother and father also kind of pushed that, you know, and said, you got to use that creative part of your brain as well. So, anyway, so what kind of, art education did you have then, dating back?
Oh, well, you know, whenever they had art class in school, you know, everybody had to take that. And usually it ended up being more craft type stuff.
Yeah.
That's when they still had art in school.
Right. Well, you also went to the Kubert School.
I did, but this is a lot later. You know, that was after I got out of high school. When I was a kid, when I was in sixth grade, my mother saw some sort of advertisement for portraiture and from a local artist. We were living in Port Angeles, Washington at the time. And my mother took some of my work to this woman without telling me. And she said, my mother was presenting it as, my son has this aptitude. Would you be willing to give him a few lessons to guide him? So the woman said, yeah. And I drew some portraits and stuff. I learned what people are doing, you know, when they're drawing portraits and they're putting their thumb against the pencil and like looking at the,
what are they doing there?
They're measuring, measuring how big your proportions so that they can then transfer them to the paper.
Interesting. Okay. That makes sense.
And you know, you see this thing, caricature of an artist drawing a portrait, sticking their arm out with a pencil. Right. But that's how I figured out what it was. So my parents would put me in these art classes, or extracurricular art classes, whenever there was an opportunity. Some of them were good.
Yeah.
This portraitist was very good.
Okay, cool.
But I've been in ones which are just glorified babysitting, you know, it's, and school, you know, you get the art ones and then you get something where there's actually something really going on.
Right.
Drawing or painting.
Did you take anything in high school at all? Outside of just the...
Well, in high school, yeah, I had art. A local woman ran an art class for a while that I took. When I was in junior high, I had a really good teacher. This is when we were still living in Washington. A really good art teacher named Ed Moriarty. And he was very open to... I mean, my mother had taken him some comics that I had drawn, so he was like, okay, well, if you're going to draw comics, which I did not have, I did not know, this was like sixth, seventh grade, I had not decided at the time that I was going to be a cartoonist,
okay.
But he said, well, if you want to draw comics, you're going to have to learn how to draw the human figure. So he was very, he was trying to give me a foundation of anatomy and things like that. I had to actually build sculptures from skeleton out. Not that I really understood what was going on. I mean, I heard him say these words, you need to know anatomy, but at the time, I'm not sure I really grasped the concept. I grasped the concept of what he was trying to do now.
Now, right. Yeah. Right, yeah. Do you think any students
at
that age?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think I was particularly stupid.
Right.
But
yeah, I'm just curious if you know... It's like math, you know, I'm never going to use this. Well, later on, you know, when you're actually using it, just wonder what kind of...
Some math.
Yeah, some math. Some math. That's a good point. That's a good point. Okay, so, Kubert School, you went there actually kind of shortly after it came about, right?
When did it started like 76.
76, so, yeah.
My first year was 81. Okay. I graduated from high school in June of 81, and I went to the Kubert School in September.
Okay, what was that like?
I mean, it seems like it was pretty early in the school's history, but it didn't seem early in the school's history back then.
Really?
Yeah, it seemed like, oh, there had been several classes through the school, and like, you know, Steve Bissett, right. Rick Veach, they were all getting work. I mean, you knew their names.
Yeah.
It seemed like a long time ago.
We just had Stephen Bissett on the show.
Yeah.
A couple weeks back, and he was talking about, because he was in the first class.
Yeah.
Of that school. So, was there anything from there that you can take away from all of that? Was there one thing that stood out from that education?
One thing. Well, I got work in comics.
Yeah, that's a good start then.
The Kubert School was a really good experience for me in many ways.
Right.
not just education about drawing comics or commercial art. It was also the first time I had ever lived away from my family, my immediate family, for any extended period of time. So that was a really good experience.
Okay.
You know, there were good things and bad things
right.
going into that. So, you know, whatever, any kid who moves away from college, moves away from home to go to college or any kind of, you know, thing, situation like that for the first time. The world is not quite what I had thought it was.
Right.
It's a lot bigger, people are a lot more nuanced.
And you got work right afterwards too, right?
I did. Well, I was very scared.
Yeah.
By the time, it's a 3-year program at the Kubert School. By the time the third year rolled around, I was very scared because it was like, oh, in 8 months, I'm going to have to get work. I have to support myself. I can't, I guess I could have gone back home to my parents, but
why would you do that?
That was not the plan. Right. The plan was I was going to get a job, get work, support myself, be a cartoonist.
Okay.
That's what I was going to school for. Mm-hmm. So, I started looking for work actively during the last semester, about January of 84. I was sending my portfolio of work out to all the various comic companies, and many had sprung up. This was the early 80s when the direct market had just begun. So all these smaller comics companies like Pacific, A First, Eclipse, what else? There was a bunch of them, had just started. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, there was still Marvel in DC, and they were in New York, and the Kubert School was just an hour away by bus from New York. So I had interviews there with editors.
Oh, cool.
And, the day, school ended on one day, then there was a day of nothing, then there was graduation. So I got my first call about work on the day of nothing, the day right after school ended.
Oh, wow.
Then the next day, which was the day of graduation, I got my second job. So
that worked out.
It timed out really, really well.
Yeah, that's...
Although, you know, I was that year at school, it was so awful. There were many reasons it was awful. One of the reasons it was awful was that I was really concerned about what I was going to do after school was out.
Right.
I was ready. If I had gotten work before school ended, I probably would have. I mean, I told myself I was going to leave school if I had gotten a substantial enough work.
Oh, really? You were ready to go?
It was not. There was situations going on that just were not happy.
Yeah. When it was time to go, it's time to go. So I think if you would have gotten that opportunity, you know, it would have been probably a wise thing, it sounds like.
I don't know. I'm glad it worked out the way it did because I graduated. I have the certificate.
Right.
Whatever that means,
you know,
it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very clear to me. It doesn't really matter if I graduate this school or not. What matters is if I get work or not. And if I can get the work, who cares what my education was?
It was a stepping stone.
No one in comics publishing really cares if I have this certificate signed by Joe Kubert.
Right. Okay. So then this next question may be a little more difficult to answer then. I'd like to ask this question sometimes. If you could go back, knowing what you know now, to that day you graduated or the day after you graduated and got that job, what kind of advice would you give yourself? But I mean, you got the job. So I guess you kind of,
I don't really have. Okay, the advice I would give myself is leave school on good terms with Joe Kubert. Leave school on good terms with everybody.
With everybody, yeah.
Because I didn't leave school with good terms, on good terms with everybody.
Okay.
Most people, but there are people I did not.
Now, we don't have to get into it, but could you have left school on good terms? I mean, was it a situation where...
Yeah, okay. Whatever problems were the responsibility of anybody else, I was also responsible for
your end of the
things that were going on too, so I could have been less of a dick.
Okay. All right. No, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Hindsight's 20/20 for sure, but...
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So be less of a dick is what you would...
Yeah, I would have had to be a little more explanatory, but
Okay. All right. Cool. All right. So I want to, were you collaborating early on? Or did you kind of start off doing your own stuff?
What do you mean by collaborating?
So
the
first
job I got was lettering. So it's total collaborative job.
Yeah. That's, you're kind of right into it.
The second job I got was illustrating someone else's script. So that was collaboration, although I penciled, lettered, and inked the whole thing myself.
Okay. Okay. So what were you working on when you first graduated then? What were your first jobs? Who were they with?
Well, the first job was from First Comics. It was lettering an issue of Warp.
Okay.
It was just before the series was canceled.
Okay.
Then they moved me on to Star Slayer. I think I lettered a couple issues of that before that was canceled. Then I started getting other work, so that's like, I don't really need this lettering anymore. The second job was from DC. It was a story in New Talent Showcase number 11 or 13 or something like that.
All right. What was that about?
It was a romance story. It was about a race car driver who thought racing was more important than his wife and child. It was written by Mindy Newell.
All right.
Edited by Karen Berger. I got the job because Joe Kubert reviewed everybody's portfolios at the end of the year. He said, you need to go up to DC and see Len Wein. So I did. I made an appointment. I was actually at DC because Dick Giordano was giving some sort of mentoring thing for young cartoonists, okay. young aspiring cartoonists. So I was at that thing and I had contacted Len at the same time and said, I'll be up at DC for this. Can I also have an appointment to see you? And he looked at my stuff and he took me over to Karen Berger's office. She was editing New Talent Showcase and Mindy Newell was in the office talking to Karen right at the same time. And she just put us together.
Awesome.
On this story.
Okay. And how long were you there?
Well, I mean, I'm freelance, so every job I get is a job.
Okay.
And it's whoever I work for.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a job with someone in particular that lasts throughout.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I got work from First Comics the whole time they were, from then on, I had work from them.
Got it. Okay.
Until they went under, and the last job I did for DC was in June, so, you know, I worked for whoever.
Yeah.
At any time.
Whoever will give you work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whoever contacts me or I can fit into my schedule or stuff like that.
Okay. So
I've never had to really struggle for work.
That's good.
Which is, that's good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think you might have gotten into it at a good time? You think that's why?
An excellent time. The early 80s, excellent time to get into comics because of the market, because all these new opportunities were opening up, all these new publishers were coming on the scene.
Yeah.
A lot of them aren't still standing. A lot of them are gone. But there was a lot of work going on at that time, a lot of good opportunity.
Okay.
So I think that was a really big reason why I got work so quickly.
That's good. You didn't burn all your bridges, I guess, then, right?
I try not to burn bridges. I mean, I had some experiences.
You tried.
and I left school not on very good terms with Joe Kubert. And for a while, I was really, really angry about it. And then years, I was really angry about it. Then for years, I was sort of regretful about it. And then finally, I don't know, it's been 10 or 12 years ago, I finally wrote him a letter. I said, look, let's just clear all this out. And he wrote back and said, he doesn't even remember.
Cool.
Yeah, he goes, I've been following your career. I'm very proud of the progress you made,
that's
stuff like
awesome.
That. So
that's good.
Joe Kubert and I made up.
Good.
Whenever I saw him at conventions after that, I always went over and talked to him.
That's cool. So going into the Age of Bronze then, this is one of your earlier, this is one of your first, right? First.
Age of Bronze?
Yeah.
No, Age of Bronze started in 98.
98. What was the one that started earlier than that?
You
started doing with the Oz ones.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
The first major job I got was inking Nexus, which I got in September or October after graduating school.
Okay.
But then that wasn't my own thing. I wanted to do my own project, which was actually an Oz comic book series. That was my idea. Okay. It turned into an Oz graphic novel series. Mm-hmm. And that sold in 85. Yeah. And then they started coming out in 86. And I did that for a few years.
And you had been into Oz since?
Since I was very, very young. Saw the Wizard of Oz movie on TV when I was, my mother says I saw it when I was 5, but I don't remember. The first time I remember it was when I was 6.
Okay.
And I loved it. I was in the bookmobile, which used to come to school, first grade. I found an abridgment of The Wizard of Oz. I grabbed it. My parents read it to me. Then we were in a bookstore and I saw they had 4 or 5 of the Oz books by L. Frank Baum there, not abridgments, the real ones.
Right,
and
right.
I'm like, wow, there are more. So I had my parents buy me one, and that was.
Do you remember what it was about it that?
No.
No, just enjoyed it, yeah.
I have always been attracted to stories where kids from our world go into some sort of magical fantasy world consistently. And I don't know whether that is because I have damage from The Wizard of Oz or whether that was just some sort of archetypal structure that really appeals to me and Oz fell into that.
I see, okay.
I don't know. You know, it doesn't, I don't really care either.
I guess by this point
but
it doesn't matter.
If people want to analyze it, I guess I can try, but, I loved Oz ever since I saw the movie, but when I finally saw the real books with illustrations by John R. Neill, I fell in love with the illustrations too.
Okay.
And that has to be a big part of the reason. But I don't know, cause,
just enjoyed them.
It just struck me somehow, and I don't know why.
And I guess you don't really need an answer or need to know why either.
I don't care, but people ask me this question. So somebody cares.
I guess in a way, I guess what I'm more driving at is I'm curious what inspires people and where they draw their inspiration from. Mm-hmm. You know, like what is it about certain things that gets them wanting to draw what they're drawing or what is it, you know, outside of just because it's work, you know, what is it about that inspires them? You, in working on The Age of Bronze, you took a very harrowing trip to Troy. I mean, you went out and did this research like that. So I'm just curious. I mean, where did that inspiration come from? Have you always, you know, like.
Okay. Well, the Trojan War, I have a very specific answer for this and I know exactly where it came from. It came from a book called The March of Folly from Troy to Vietnam by Barbara Tuchman. I often listen to books, recorded books, when I'm inking or painting. And I was listening to that book in February 1991.
Yeah.
And there's a chapter on the Trojan War and how stupid the Trojans were to draw the wooden horse into their city, even though there were all these obvious signs why it was a bad idea. Hence the march of hence their folly.
Folly
keeps going on throughout history. Anyway, in this chapter, she made it clear that there were many different many different versions of the Trojan War, written since antiquity.
Okay.
And some of them were contradictory and some of them had different emphases. And I'm just like, oh, that's really interesting. What if I took every single version of the Trojan War ever created and put them all together and reconciled all the differences and set it in the correct period, wouldn't that make a great comic book? And you know, it was like, no way, that'd be a huge project. That's way too much to take on. That'd be like 5 years.
Oh, no.
But I kept having interest in the project. I mean, my interest in this idea didn't go away. So I just go, okay, I'm going to do this. I don't care how long it takes.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
And why not? If you had the time to work on it, you had the interest.
I have other ideas. I have other projects I'd like to do, but this one, you know, if you have an idea and it goes away and then you find a note that you wrote years later and it's like, oh yeah, I had that idea. You know, it wasn't the idea for you, but if you have an idea and it just doesn't go away.
Yeah.
That's the idea. That's the project to work on.
So have you never gone back to draw on any things that you've kind of stopped working on? Decided that, you know, I think I'm going to move on to the next project. Do you ever go back?
I don't really have time to spend doing things that I don't have the luxury of time to do stuff like that. Okay. I usually have a project. I usually have projects, and they've all got to get done.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are, I mean, there are things that I've usually, okay, this is the way it works. I have an idea, and I know if it's going to be a project that I'm going to be interested in. So mm-hmm. I will write notes, always write notes.
Yeah.
If I'm serious about something, I always make sure I write notes down because otherwise I'll just forget. And put the notes aside, and when I have time, then I work on it. Okay. So, but it's always with the intention that, yeah, this is going to be a project someday.
Okay. Okay. Do you have some that you have not worked on, like written notes for and decided, no, I'm just not going to?
There was a big project that was just before Age of Bronze, which was going to be on ancient Egypt, which I got to the proposal stage mm-hmm. for. But for various reasons, it didn't happen.
Okay.
One was, sort of collapsed under its own weight because we have so much research from ancient Egypt that I was gathering all this research and it was just becoming overwhelming. When I began Age of Bronze soon after that, and when I began looking at the research from the Bronze Age Aegean world for Age of Bronze, I kept seeing the same artifacts over and over and over, and it was such a relief because I thought, well, I can get my head around this, where I couldn't really for ancient Egypt. So that's one reason that collapsed. The other reason it collapsed was I was trying to tell a story which maybe, I don't know, maybe I wasn't ready to tell. It was sort of, there was a romance element in it. Very complicated romance, doomed romance. And I had people read it, you know, people mm-hmm. who, to comment on this proposal that I was coming up with, which had some script in it, or it had an outline of the whole thing and some script. And the responses I was getting just weren't, it didn't work with what I was trying to do.
Okay.
So that was another reason this just didn't work. It didn't go anywhere.
Okay.
I don't know if I'll ever go back to it. I have a friend who has seen all the material and he's like, you should work on this. And I'm like, I'm not in that place anymore.
Yeah. There's a reason you stopped.
Yeah.
It's kind of a thing. Yeah. Okay. All right. I when I write, I have a lot of half stories, and a lot of it I've learned now is because I tried to edit while writing, which is really just not a good way of going about anything. But I every once in a while I'll go back and see if I can draw on old things and expand on that to fit something I'm currently working on.
Right. Right.
So I'm as I was curious with the other thing, I'm always curious about that with artists and people like that as well, and if they go back to that. So do you, you went to Troy to, did you go there for research for Age of Bronze or had you always wanted to?
Well, I started the research on Age of Bronze in 92. The series began publication in 98.
Okay.
I went to Troy finally in 2006.
Okay. So it was a little while.
So it was after I had been always wanting to go.
Sure. Sure.
It was just dedicating the money and the time to doing it. Mm-hmm. But the excavations that are still going on opened there in 1988. So they were finding all this new stuff. It was mainly headed by Professor Manfred Korfmann from Tübingen University in Germany. Mm-hmm. He was in charge of the whole project and he was in charge of the Bronze Age stuff. Actually, the American team, which was part of this, from the University of Cincinnati was in charge of the post-Bronze Age, which is not what I was interested in.
Okay.
So I had to look at the German stuff more. Anyway, Korfmann died in 2005, and that was a big like wake up call to me. It was like, well, I had met him and talked with him a little bit in 97.
Okay.
I had a conference, and I had always wanted to and I had exchanged a little bit of correspondence with him after Age of Bronze started, but I'd always assumed he would always be around, or he'd be around for a long time, but then he died in 2005, premature. He was in his 50s.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't expected then.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It was very premature. So I decided, well, I better go to Troy. So I went in the next year when the excavations were on.
Did you get anything out of it that may have altered the current story in any way?
No.
Okay.
Going to the site was one of the best things I've ever done in my life. I was there for 12 days. Yeah. I did a lot of hiking. I did some sketching. I did a lot of picture taking and a lot of videoing.
Okay.
I went while the excavations were on. The excavations are only in the summer because all these archaeologists teach and they can't work on digs, during the school year.
Right.
So I talked to the archaeologists and I had talked to some of them beforehand and they gave me tours. I got three tours from three different people and, you know, they're all slightly different. No one agrees on everything.
Right.
It was very valuable for Age of Bronze, but it was more of a confirmation of a lot of things because I had been working from photographs and books I had done tons and tons of research. So I knew what I was going to be seeing.
Okay.
What was the most useful about it was not the actual city of Troy, which is really in ruins, and the Bronze Age level is, at least the specific Bronze Age level that I'm interested in, there's really not much left. And getting it from books was as useful as going there. What was most useful to me was surrounding the city, seeing where aspects of the landscape that I knew about were in relation to everything else, how far the distance is from Troy to the bay south of the city where current theory believes if there was a Trojan War,
where
the Achaean army would have camped.
Oh, okay.
And you can look on maps and I can see how far it is from books, but until you actually walk it, you don't really have real concept of, I didn't have a real concept of what exactly it was like. I didn't know how many hills were between there. I didn't know what was there. It's hard to get from books. Much better to get from actually going. And the island right off the coast, which plays a part in the story. I could find a few photos online from that, but I could not really find the information that I needed to be able to put characters in a setting on that island. And I had to draw that island before I went, so I was just sort of winging it from clues, stray clues here and there in books and things I had read online. So once I got to the island, it was gratifying in that some of the things were very much how I guessed they were, and some of the things weren't.
Sure.
So now I can get it right when we have scenes on that island again.
you kind of broke even in a way too, yeah.
Well, I was really kind of amazed. Like I rented a bicycle to ride around the island, and I was riding on this on the road toward the west end of the island, which is where the wooded area was, which is where I had set an important scene in the book. And all the woods were pine trees, and I hadn't drawn pine trees. So it was well. I know better now.
Now you know, yeah.
But I came to this clearing, and it was like, oh, I know exactly where I am. I drew this clearing.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that was really neat. Yeah. And then there's beaches on the south side of the island, but there's cliffs. But on the map, it's all these tourist beaches now. And I'm like, oh, I drew all the cliffs there. But there's supposed to be cliffs there. Well, let's go see. So I rode my bike over there, and yeah, there are cliffs. But there are all these beaches down below. So the fact that there are all these beaches there doesn't really matter because, fine, there's beaches then too. There just wasn't tourists lying on them.
Right. That would have been interesting.
Yeah. And I looked out, and I'd drawn the Achaean fleet sailing past the island, and I looked out on the water, and there were these ships, you know, oil tankers and cargo ships and things. It was like, well, I, you know, everything's updated, but yeah, I got it right, basically.
That's awesome. So you got some confirmation.
Yeah. So that was really, really great. That's great good. Experience.
That's good. So where is it now? Where's the story now?
Where's the story now? Yeah. Well, I've been stalled for a while, but I'm working every day on issue 34.
Wow. Okay.
We're still in the early days of the war. I just finally got through with all the Troilus and Cressida stuff, which was actually very, very difficult for me to do.
Okay.
And now we're back to what I'm working on right now is the meeting of Achilles and Helen on Mount Ida, which was sort of a challenge in figuring out how to get those two characters together. But I started laying the groundwork long ago in the series, so it's working. But I don't want to give too much away.
No, I understand completely. So how much more do you have? Do you think you have left?
I have about 2/3 of the story still to go.
Wow. So job security, right?
I
guess.
Yeah. Whatever. I mean,
job supplement?
Whatever.
it's work.
It's just what I'm doing.
Right. Okay. So let's.
At this point, I need to take on a little other work at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually, in the interest of time, want to skip a question about Hungry Press, but just kind of briefly, Hungry Tiger Press.
Hungry Tiger Press. Yeah.
Can you kind of give an idea of what the background of that and what that's about?
Hungry Tiger Press is currently the small publishing company that my partner David Maxine runs.
Okay.
We co-founded it in 1994, for two purposes. One was to publish his, he wanted to edit an anthology of Oz fiction, comic stories, verse, art. And the other purpose was to publish Age of Bronze. So we started this in 94. The direct market kind of crashed in 95. And Diamond was the only only major distributor left standing. So I saw a lot of other comic self-publishers really struggling at the time. So, I decided that Hungry Tiger Press was not the place to go with Age of Bronze, that I needed, someone who wasn't me publishing it.
Sure. Okay. All right. Now, one thing, and then we'll kind of wrap up. Over the last 20 or 30 years, you've been kind of in the industry working through it. What's been your biggest test in all of that time, even through the changes and that comic creation, or even, you know, the industry itself has seen in that time? Is there a big hurdle that you've had to jump?
No, my career has always been a mixture of comics that I've taken a job where an editor's called me up or emailed me and I've taken a job, and the type of project where I come up with a project and sell it to a publisher. So, and I've been very happy with that.
Yeah.
I get to do what I want, and then every once in a while I get to do some project that I never would have thought of, probably.
That's great.
And I also get to work on characters that I liked when I was a kid, although I pretty much struck them all off the checklist by now.
Yeah.
Although, I wrote and drew an Uncle Scrooge story, for Gladstone just as they were going under, and it never got approved by Egmont in Italy, which was the branch of Egmont that had to approve everything. And so it's not done. I mean, I drew it. It's not inked, and it'll probably never see print.
Okay.
Huh. But that's not my biggest hurdle. The biggest hurdle is just getting the work done on time. That's always the challenge.
Yeah,
that's what you have to be.
Time. Okay. Time is seems to be a problem for a lot of people. I'm always inspired by people who have figured out how to make it work for them and to create time. I see people create time somehow, and I'm like, I don't know, Jim Zub. I don't know how he does so much stuff and creates so much, but anyway. All right. Let's finish up here.
I might have a hurdle question.
Oh, yeah?
I did a project in the early 90s called The Elsewhere Prince. I was approached by Jean-Marc and Randy Lefissier. They were working with Mobius, and this was an extension of the Airtight Garage, which is one of Mobius's more famous projects. And they asked me to draw it, and they sent me the outline, and I just didn't know whether I wanted it or not, but I thought the opportunity to work with Mobius on this project was really, really good, and I ought to take it, yeah. So I did. And then when I had to sit down and draw the project, I just didn't want to do it. It was really difficult for me to get through. And although many, many good things happened to me because of that project, I worked with Mobius a little bit. He wasn't really that involved with it, but yeah. I did have a few meetings with him. And I got to friendship with Randy and Jean-Marc. And also this project got printed in almost every European country there is. And I got lots of money. I got paid cool. very, very well for it. So these were good things. But I sort of learned from that project, make sure if you're going to take on a large project, it's something you really, really want to do.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see how that would, because, yeah. Do you think that that's, and we got to wrap up, but do you think that that's a hard thing to do nowadays? It seems almost easier.
For me, I've been working in this business for 30 years. It's easier for me to recognize what I like, a project that, what are the reasons I will work on a project. Yeah. It's easier for me to make those decisions. But then I was still in my 20s. I was in the middle of doing this Oz graphic novel series, which I was totally the motivator for.
Sure.
And they were asking me, I was very flattered that someone was asking me to do this project, and the opportunity seemed really good. It's just that the material didn't really speak to me. And although I read it, I didn't really have a problem with it. So it was like, why not? But I didn't recognize it as, this is just not
what you want to,
this is not an idea that I will love.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see how that would be difficult to really put all your into it.
I couldn't recognize, I just couldn't recognize it at the time.
Yeah.
That this would be so hard for me to get through. But I got through it, and there were very many good things that came out of it. So I don't regret doing it at all. So that was sort of a learning lesson,
And that sounds like a good one. I wonder if everybody encounters that at some point. You know, I guess people just take work to get work. You know, so I know that's part of my job.
Yeah. The day, so one thing that Jose Delbo told me before I graduated from the Kubert School, he says, don't ever say no when someone's offering you work. And my first thought was, well, what if I don't have time? What if I have so much work I don't have time? But he just didn't want me to turn anything down.
Sure.
That might be an opportunity. And I have turned down work because I don't have time. If I can't fit something on my schedule, I have to turn it down. If I don't think I'm the person for this job, if I don't think I'm going to do a good job on it, I will turn it down.
Right, right.
If I think I'm going to tear my hair out, I will turn it down.
Turn it down. Yeah. That makes sense. That's hard. It's hard to reconcile all that. I'm sure even when you're 20s and you're getting those offers, you know, when you have to say no because you just don't have time, you know, so. All right, Eric, where can people find you online? If you can give us an idea, your social media stuff, contact info.
Well, my website is www.age-of-bronze.com.
Okay.
I'm also on Facebook under my own name.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Well, Eric, thanks.
I'm not a twit.
You're not a Twitter? You're not a Twitter guy? Instagram?
No.
None of that stuff?
No. I don't have time for all that stuff.
You're trying to work, right?
Or something.
Or something. Nice. All right, Eric. Well, thanks for sitting down with us. I'm glad we got to do this.
You're welcome, Adam. Thank you.
I gotta say, it was pretty great to hear that Eric's parents were so supportive of his artistic side, and the fact that he and his sister got to go pick out comics. That was pretty cool. Having supportive parents for anything creative or constructive you do really can be an advantage. Now, that is not to say that it's impossible to be successful without good parents, but I mean, people do it all the time. But having parents that understand your strengths and help you grow those strengths instead of pushing you into something you may not want to do or something you may not do well at can really be a major factor sometimes. So I also thought it was pretty cool that when he went to Troy and visited the areas he had been drawing for so long, he got some confirmation that he was pretty accurate with the landscape. Though, I still think it would have been kind of funny if there were beachgoers tanning while the Greeks attacked. Anyway, Eric, thank you for coming on the show. I am glad we were able to meet up. It was pretty cool to have you on the MOOC back in April and now as a solo guest on the podcast, so thanks for that. And again, thank you to Alchemy Restaurant here in the South Park neighborhood of San Diego for allowing Eric and me to conduct business. If you're in town or, visiting in town, or if you live here, be sure to visit the restaurant and try everything on the menu because it is all good. Especially that grass-fed burger. Holy crap. Anyway, as for us, make sure you visit the website, makingcomics.com. Up at the top, subscribe to the newsletter. Make sure you're signed up to get the daily mini challenge. Also, check out webcomicunderdogs.com. They are a great comic creators community and forum we have partnered up with. Just some fantastic people over there. Plus, you all know the creators, Michael Yakutis and Marisa Brenizer. I know that you guys have heard them as co-hosts a time or two. So that's them. It's pretty cool. All right, you can find me online on Twitter at SDGreeny. Send me a love letter to ag@makingcomics.com and feel free to paint me a picture. I accept gifts. As for next Friday, check us out for another fantastic artist. As for the rest of the time, be good to people, people. We'll be right back.